This is True Crime Psychology and Personality, where we discuss the pathology behind some of the most horrific crimes and those who committed them from a scientifically informed perspective.
I'm Dr. Todd Grande. I have a PhD in counselor education and supervision, and I'm a licensed professional counselor of mental health. Dr. Todd Grande, that's my YouTube channel.
Today's question is, can I analyze the case of Jesse Blodgett and Dan Bartelt? First, I'll look at the background of this case, move to the timeline of the crime, then offer my analysis. Jesse Blodgett was born on March 22, 1994, in Marietta, Georgia. When she was 3 years old, her family moved to Hartford, Wisconsin, which is a small town about 45 minutes northwest of Milwaukee. She lived with her parents, Buck and Joy. Jesse was highly interested in music for most of her life. She was both a singer and a piano player and was considered exceptionally talented. When she was in high school, she met a teenager named Daniel Bartelt, who went by the name Dan. The couple briefly dated and remained friends after this. Like Jesse, Dan was interested in music, although his skill level was not in the same league. He would hold a guitar and move the strings with his fingers to create unpleasant sounds. Dan referred to this behavior as playing the guitar. He represented himself as the lead singer of a band called Angry Pillows. The name Angry Audience would have been more accurate. Dan also participated in behaviors he referred to as singing and acting, and was attempting to write a fiction novel about murder titled Red is Red. After high school, Jesse and Dan attended different colleges. Jesse stayed busy not only with school, but giving music lessons to students in the Blodgett family house. Dan dropped out of college, found a full-time job, and reconnected with Jesse. About once a week, he stopped by the Blodgett family house, and they would work on music together. Eventually, Dan stopped working at his job, but he told people he was still employed. He would even leave his parents' house in the day, pretending to go to work. Now moving to the timeline of the crime. On Friday, July 12, 2013, Jesse Blodgett performed in a community theater production of Fiddler on the Roof. This was the opening weekend of the show, and Jesse was playing the lead role. She performed not only on Friday, but on Saturday and Sunday as well. Jesse probably viewed this as the sunrise of her career, but unfortunately, it was the sunset. After the performance on Sunday, the cast and crew of the production attended a pool party at a llama farm. At about 12:30 a.m., now on Monday, July 15, Jesse returned to the Blodgett family house. She was upset because two men in their 40s allegedly made passes at her during the party. Before going to sleep for the night, Jesse recorded entries about the incident in her journal. In the morning, her mother, Joy, checked on Jesse before going to work. This was at about 8 a.m. Joy returned home for lunch, and a new student for Jesse showed up at around 12:30 p.m. Joy called for Jesse, but did not get a response. She went to Jesse's bedroom and found Jesse in her bed, unresponsive. There were marks around her neck. Joy called 911 and told the operator that her daughter was blue and would not wake up. When the police arrived, they found that 19-year-old Jesse was dead. Here's what the police found during the course of their investigation. Jesse had been strangled and was the victim of an assault of a sexual nature. Nothing appeared to be stolen from the house, and it was not ransacked. There was no forced entry, but the doors were often unlocked, so anybody could have walked in. The two men who allegedly made passes at Jesse were ruled out as potential suspects. As the investigation continued, it ended up intersecting with another investigation, which initially seemed unrelated. On Friday, July 12, 3 days before Jesse was killed, a woman named Melissa Richards was walking her dog in Richfield Park. When she was in the gravel parking lot, a young man attacked her with a knife. She managed to grab the blade with her hands and take the knife away from him. The man attempted to get the knife back from her, but Melissa prevented this. Eventually, the man said, "Can I just go?" The man ran away, entered a blue Dodge Caravan, and drove away from the park. Melissa had cuts on both her hands and on one of her legs, but she survived and contacted the police. She offered them an excellent description of the perpetrator and of his vehicle. Furthermore, she still had the knife that was used to attack her. 2 months before this attack, a police officer had spotted a blue Dodge Caravan in the park and recorded the license plate. The officer didn't think much of it at the time, but now that license plate seemed important. On July 16, the day after Jesse was murdered, the police learned that the Dodge Caravan was registered to a married couple. Neither of these people matched the description of the attacker. However, they had a son who did. Their son's name was Dan Bartelt. When the police called Dan, they discovered he was actually at the Blodgett family house consoling Jesse's parents. Dan agreed to be interviewed without an attorney. After initially denying any involvement in Melissa's attack, he admitted that he was the perpetrator. To explain his actions, he said, quote, "Life scares me, and I don't particularly think I'm very good at it, and I wanted to scare someone else because everyone else is confident. I don't understand it," unquote. The police asked Dan what happened with Jesse, like why was he visiting the Blodgett family house. He explained that Jesse was murdered and was the victim of an assault of a sexual nature. At this point, the information about the assault was not available to the public. Dan was arrested for the attack on Melissa and charged with first-degree attempted homicide, first-degree recklessly endangering safety, and false imprisonment. The next day, January 17, the police interviewed Dan about Jesse's murder. Even though he had admitted to attacking Melissa, Dan denied murdering Jesse. He said that on the day of the murder, he was at Woodlawn Union Park. In his effort to provide an alibi, Dan actually led the police to evidence of his guilt. The police searched the trash cans in the park and found a cereal box containing duct tape, sanitizing wipes, and ropes. DNA from both Dan and Jesse were on the ropes. One of the ropes matched marks that were left on Jesse's neck, and another rope matched marks left on her wrists and ankles. The duct tape was an unusual brand, which was not sold in any store in the area. The same brand of tape was found underneath Jesse's bed and in the residence where Dan lived with his parents. On July 31, 2013, Dan Bartelt was charged with first-degree intentional homicide. In 2014, he was convicted of that charge. In October of that year, he was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Later, Dan pleaded guilty to first-degree reckless endangerment in connection with the attack on Melissa Richards. He received another 5 years to be served consecutively with his life sentence. Now moving to my analysis. Here are my thoughts on a few areas that stood out to me in this case. Item number one. After Dan was arrested, investigators discovered he had a number of unusual interests. A few examples. He was fascinated by violent films involving clothing-challenged characters. One of the films had a plot which was similar to the circumstances of Jesse's murder. Dan searched the internet for information on spree killers and serial killers. He had an intense interest in bondage. There were images of bondage on his computer, and it was prominently featured in the novel that he was attempting to write. This book contained a series of stories about a young girl who would eventually be murdered. The character's name was Jessica. Item number two, it is reasonable to believe that Dan had a sexual interest in Jesse. They had dated for a few months in high school and later spent time together just about every week to work on music. Jesse said that on one occasion when Dan was at the Blodgett family house, he pulled her in for a kiss out of nowhere. This was disturbing to Jesse and she was angry about it. After the murder, Dan implied that he recently had consensual sex with Jesse, which was her idea. This is highly unlikely. He probably said this because it was part of his fantasy to be with her. Item number three. At his sentencing, Dan continued to deny any involvement in Jesse's murder. He told Jesse's parents that he could not give them the answers they were looking for. He said, quote, "This jumpsuit that I'm wearing, these shackles that I'm put in, don't make me guilty," unquote. Dan recognized that he could not refute the evidence against him. He talked about how he only went to trial because he was not permitted to take an Alford plea. In this type of plea, a defendant recognizes that the state has enough evidence to convict them while still maintaining their innocence. Dan told the judge, quote, "I can't prove that I'm innocent to anyone not even myself, unquote. The addition of the words, not even myself, is telling. It's almost like Dan was trying to confess without actually saying the words. Item number 4, what do I think happened in this case? This is just a theory, my opinion. Dan Bartelt was impulsive, irresponsible, grandiose, self-centered, deceptive, manipulative, sadistic, excitement-seeking, cold, callous, attention-seeking, charismatic, shallow, and had a sense of entitlement. He was highly interested in sexual dominance. His fantasy was pervasive and left him with an intense desire to control and harm women. This influenced his reading selections, his writing, and his film preferences. All he could think about was murder. He was obsessed with it. At some point, he transformed into an aspiring serial killer. His intense interest pushed him to attack Melissa in the parking lot of the Richfield Park. The preparations he made for the attack were insufficient. Dan was not wearing a disguise because he did not intend for his victim to survive. Melissa managed to fight him off, which put Dan in a challenging situation. His victim had the knife, knew what he looked like, and saw his vehicle. He should have known that there was a good chance he was going to be arrested soon. Instead of trying to stay out of sight for a while, Dan went in another direction and murdered Jesse 3 days later. Maybe he believed that he was never going to get caught for the attack on Melissa, so he wasn't worried about carrying out a second attack. Another possibility is that he did believe he was going to be arrested, which meant he needed to act quickly or he would lose his chance to murder Jesse. Dan probably fantasized about attacking Jesse for quite some time. In his mind, she was an ideal target for several reasons. She had romantically rejected him. He had a way to approach her in her house when she was alone. He could surprise her when she was sleeping, which would prevent her from fighting back. And if he left DNA or other evidence in her room, he had a non-homicidal explanation for it. Again, he had been regularly visiting the Blodgett family house. After murdering Jesse, Dan spent time consoling her parents because he wanted them to trust him. Furthermore, seeing them suffer for something that he did may have satisfied his sadistic tendencies. Dan wanted a good view of his handiwork. Now moving to my final thoughts. As I mentioned, Dan may have been an aspiring serial killer. There were many similarities between his personality and typical serial killer characteristics. For example, Dan was manipulative, charismatic, irresponsible, and motivated by a desire for sexual dominance. In other ways, however, Dan's traits did not match an aspiring serial killer. For example, he was not a loner like most serial killers. Dan actually had a large group of friends. He may have been creepy, but did not immediately strike people as creepy. Those around him did not look at him and think, this is a guy who's going to commit murder someday. As a matter of fact, he was just about the last person anyone would have suspected. Dan had a girlfriend around the time of the murder, and he was attention-seeking, like he had performed on stage. An argument could be made that Dan was the scariest kind of killer there is, one who doesn't express obvious signs of being dangerous, and one who was willing to violate the trust of a close friend.
This has been True Crime Psychology and Personality from Ars Longa Media. This content is for educational and entertainment purposes only. Ars Longa, Vita Brevis.